This is Notes from a Native Daughter. I am Sol Daniela. My guest today is George Emilio Sanchez, chairperson and professor of the Department of Performing and Creative Arts at the College of Staten Island. I hope you enjoy.
Well, because you're now a professor, you're a chairperson, you wear a lot of hats. It's a lot of responsibility. It's such a privilege to have a humanities position like the one you have in this day and age.
That's very true. I'm very lucky.
You are. Yeah. And so, you know, you're like 1%. You're like, you know what I'm saying? In that sphere, and also representing brown people, communities of color.
Big time.
You know, and that is just a wondrous thing. So I'm thinking, like, you know, where you are now had a past that informed how you, I guess, first of all, confront and decide to look into social justice and the arts and fuse that together and run with it, and make a career out of it.
All of it by accident, all of it not planned, not intentional. And it's kind of, I guess, the beauty of unconsciously and unintentionally knowing that there was something I had to follow in terms of my own passion, in terms of what I wanted in life, that it feels very organic now and very tied to who I am, but it's just been such a struggle. And so how did I get into this? I moved from California to come to New York to become an actor. It was that simple. It was that basic. And that trajectory, that training, that education, where I was working in bookstores, working in restaurants, did odd jobs in New York, and then studying at night to act. And then once I started to work in commercial, in television, in films, it was really horrible. But that kind of paralleled a consciousness I had that in my pursuit to become an actor, to work in the theater, it didn't align whatsoever with my life, with my politics. And once I started to get involved with people that were making their own work and then seeing how these things could merge. So when I started to do a play that traveled around the country called The Peasant of El Salvador, that was really the birth of it. And then knowing that there were people that make their own work, this was like a revelation to me. I had no idea what that was. So what people call now performance artists, which I claim, it was really new. And it was, I didn't know what I was getting into. And so I did it because I wanted to make work that spoke to my interests and my values and my identity. I didn't see it. Didn't mean it didn't exist. I just didn't see it. And so that's what launched it. So I started to write my own pieces. I started to produce myself. I went on tour. I did everything out of necessity and survival. It wasn't like I knew how to do it. And it was fantastic. I mean, it's the best thing that could have happened. There's no way I could have had a career track, you know, that would have got me here where I am today. It's impossible. I don't know how. So it was also because I had my feet and my hands and my soul and my eyes in many places at once. So it wasn't just like, I'm going to do theater. I'm going to do theater, but I'm going to work with an after-school program in New York City where somebody had the courage or the stupidity to hire me to be the director of a dropout prevention program in high schools. And I had to manage three people working in eight high schools on a dropout prevention program. It's called Global Kids. I'm very proud to say they're still in existence. They're doing amazing work. But I was the first director. We got that going. We took kids from East New York to the UN to meet international leaders to talk about what's going on in East New York, Brooklyn. It was fantastic. It was great. So, gosh, it's so much. So as a director, I had to find out how to create a curriculum and how to train people to do this work. That led me to go to Bard College and go to the Writing and Thinking Institute, and that's what got me into BOAL. So I wanted to find other teaching tools for our staff, and I had to do it first, and that's why I got to BOAL. So when I met BOAL at the Breck Forum. The Breck Forum and NYU were the first people to bring Augusto BOAL to New York or to the States from Brazil, and that's where this is where this began. I mean, I can keep going, but I'm going to stop there, right?
No, continue. So they come to New York. You take the workshop.
So, okay. So this was the beginning of really coming together. So I'm working in a dropout prevention program. I'm working at Thomas Jefferson High School in East New York. That's probably one of the first places where in the country, I only realized this week. I can't believe this. There was a shooting in the school in 1991. Kid was shot and killed. Then in March of 1992, two kids are shot and killed in the school on the day that David Dinkins was going to come and speak. And there's cops. There's everybody there. A kid got a gun in, shot two kids, one in the head, one in the heart. They both died. One died like 50 feet from my office. So the problems that were going on were not in the news as much as people might have thought it was. Guns in schools was really a really regular common thing. And East New York is the highest murder rate in New York City, 75th precinct. And I was working in the schools there. It was an unbelievable situation where the principal would pull me out of a class and say, George, you got to go to the library and do grief counseling. I'd never been trained in it. So Boal was an opportunity who teaches Theater of the Oppressed, which comes out of Pedagogy of the Oppressed. They use this theater as a teaching tool to try to get to something that we call spect actors. It's about creating an environment where everyone that's involved is engaged and is a participant. There are no observers. And the way you do that is by working real simply with trust exercises and using theater as a tool to get us to look at the society we live in, how we exist, how we relate, how we communicate or don't. So there's many different levels of Theater of the Oppressed. It's very intense. There's many levels of it. And now more people know about it. But back then, that was the springboard that got me into really making my own work and merging all these, intersecting all these different worlds.
That's amazing. And when does it become, I guess, a human necessity for you to do that?
The necessity is a given. It's a given because we never allow ourselves. We live in a country where we have such historical trauma around many issues that now gets talked about in terms of racism. It's like, oh, there's a historical trauma. We live in a violent country. When you look at the history of the country, from the beginning, it's so violent that historical lineage that we have, the trauma that comes with it, that may not touch us directly, but that's the environment we live in, and it's very violent. And so there's no way you cannot understand that the necessity right now, in my view, and for my whole life, is a necessity. So whether it's conscious or not, whether it's intentional or not, there's a need for education, social justice, awareness, communication, trust. It's basic. And most schools don't provide that. You know, they try to provide something to give skills and tools, but it's such a politicized picture because it's not the same schooling everywhere. We don't have the same access to good education. It's very politicized because of race, demographics, and whatnot. So in New York City, it's pretty simple. You can go to the best schools, and you can go to the most impoverished schools in one train ride. And that's an unbelievable world to live in. So I'll have 5 borough days. I mean, I literally be in all 5 boroughs in one day. I'll go meet with students. I meet with teachers. I'll meet with this, you know, Bronx Museum of the Arts and do a workshop in a junior high school. And it's just amazing how in one city, we have all these things right in our face, but people just don't want to really acknowledge this is the landscape. So one of the things that theater can do is connect people. It really can connect people. It really can create an environment where you're able to listen to somebody else's story. And it's that basic. We have to do that time and time and time and time again in order to get to something like violence, gun violence, to get to racism, to get to sexism, to get to the issues around transgender identity and why they're going to be like, you know, in this horrible situation right now with Trump and whatnot. So the necessity to me is ever present.
Yeah. And so then to go back to that juncture, once you become a teacher.
Right.
In New York City.
Yeah.
What happens next with you in terms of your other interests as an artist?
So I wouldn't be here if I didn't have my personal art making. It sounds dramatic. I say it a lot, but I never could see myself living past the age of 25 when I was a kid. I couldn't see myself as an adult. It was a blank. So I got stuck because it's a moment that it just kind of shatters me. The first thing that I really made I made a play with a friend called Flight of the Quetzal about something going on in Guatemala and El Salvador in the 80s. But my first piece was really an autobiographical piece that I didn't intend to be a solo piece. I wanted it to be a group piece and I wasn't going to be in it. But when I first started to write it, and I did a reading of it to a bunch of friends, and they were like, this is your piece, and you have to do this alone. And I really was so frightened. And yet, it was the right thing to do. And that experience of reading, research, and finding parallels between my personal story, and then to see the bigger picture of how my personal story reflected many personal stories in a context that involved things like racism, it was like, whoa, shit, this is not an accident. This is not just by chance. This is intentional and it's meant to be. And I'm supposed to feel this way, powerless and invisible. Once I realized that actually there's a way out by becoming aware, by reading, by meeting people, by working, that changed everything. So my making my first solo piece, Chief Halfbreed in the Land of In Between, El Cacique Cholo in the Land of Nepantla. It has three languages in it. That was on purpose because I think we need to do multilingual things. So that really changed my life, you know. It really changed my life, and it's why I continue to make work. I no longer make work that's solely autobiographical. I could make a solo piece again and I just got tired of it. I don't want to do that. I try to do other things now, but I could do it I know it so well. And I write things all the time, but I really don't want to do that. I think that time is over, and I think we have to do different kinds of work. Although young people I work with, they need to do it, you know. But I'm on a different track.
What other type of work?
One of the things about, one of the things that a primary thing about writing is, don't write about anything you don't know, right? And so I really kept to that in my pieces. All the pieces I made had to do with my experience, or not had to do with, but were based in an experience I had some sense of, and then I could build off that. And then you realize at a certain point, you can write about anything. And so I would use myself as a focal point, but start to bridge out more. And so I just have more courage to try and break away from the construct that I created for myself. And it's scary to do it. The thing I'm trying to do now, to talk about gun violence, that supposedly isn't about my experience. And then I realize, oh my God, of course I have that experience. We all do, you know, we all do. So I get hired.
You get hired.
Yeah. Diana Taylor had invited me to teach a Bawal workshop in her performance studies class for 1 or 2 years, I can't remember. And then all of a sudden, Diana, out of the Hemispheric Institute, they decided to create Emerge NYC that was going to be working with, at that time it was working with, you didn't have to be Latino, but that was kind of part of it, but it was just working with young people and creating a laboratory environment of them making their own work. It was more loosely defined, but Diana wanted to try this. Her model was, I don't know if she said it, but I know that part of her inspiration, I believe, was, and maybe I'm just making this up, but she knew of many different companies that work in Latin America that are quite different than the U.S. because Yuya Chicani, for example, is in Lima, Peru, and it's a Peruvian company.
I know they are.
Yuya Chicani is amazing. So I had a Fulbright in 94, and I went and studied with Yuya Chicani for 3 months while I was teaching in the schools in a, what was that? An anti-drug program or something with sexual, I can't remember. Anyways, they're amazing, but the situation there is you can't replicate that in the United States. There's just no way you can replicate what they have. They have a base, they have a theater. They have the same company for many, many, many years. That's really hard to do in the United States. It just doesn't really happen. There's a couple of places, Mabu Minds, the Wooster Group, avant-garde experimental theaters who were, they're fantastic people, but it's very, very difficult. So that was kind of what I think she had in mind. But after the first year, we changed it and we really pinpointed. Diana created this thing. I interviewed. I got hired. And from that point, really, it's been Marlene and I that have really shaped it to the where it is now. And, you know, in the beginning, there was a lot more exploration and a lot of, we were really trying to figure out how do we create this program that hopefully people would be interested in. And I think we're both pretty shocked and surprised and really, really, really so incredibly elated that it exists for 10 years. There's an interest and people talk about it. And the applicants we get every year are just as amazing people. So, yeah, it's been great. That's great.
You know, maybe go for 4 or 5 bullets.
Okay. What have I learned? Listen, listen, listen. Just listen, listen, listen. I've learned so much from all the participants. 10 years. There's like 200 people or close to 200 people that have been through the program. I mean, it's amazing. There's like about 200 people or close to that I have learned about somebody else's life, somebody else's challenge, somebody else's strength, somebody else's vulnerability. It's
amazing.
And because it's not just a casual thing. I mean, I have students at the college that I know very well, but Emerge is different. I really have learned so much. I've been very lucky. They're just beautiful people.
If you were to grab at something like a thread, what threads all these emerging?
Well, you know, I see myself in every one of them. I see myself in everyone because they're exploring. They have the courage to say, I want to do something, but I really don't know. I don't know if I can do it. I don't have the skill set. I don't know what I'm going to do after I'm done. I don't know what I'm going to do in life. You know, they have real basic questions because at the heart of it, they want to live in a different world. They want to live in a world where they can feel that they're a part of. I mean, every single one of them, okay? It's beautiful. But the problem is that...
The swamp.
I mean, you know, it's true because, I mean, one of the difficult things is that we do these programs, we get really close, and I have a relationship with many of them that goes on, but, you know, I don't want to do something and make them feel that they have this power and they have this, and then the program ends and then what? And they're like, what do we do now? I said, that's up to you. That's the hardest thing for me to say. You know, it's like, well, that's up to you. Mm-hmm. We have to let go, you know. We don't let go. We hang on as long as we can, but... You know, to try to be an artist in the 21st century in the United States is the craziest, most ambitious, most frightening thing to do. To say you're going to dedicate your life to art making and do it with a sense of activism, that's counterproductive. That goes against everything this culture wants people to do. And that's why these people are great. They're so brave. They're so courageous. They have been able to tune out their families, their lovers, their peers, the education to say, no, I'm first, and this is what I'm going to do. But the I'm first with this group is really about we. The I'm first is really about a we. It's really not about me first. And I mean, I've had many people get like, oh, no, this is just about me. It's good. Let it be about you. It's really okay. The other bullet is dare to fail. I mean, I say this every year. It becomes a mantra when we have, I said, I want you to dare to fail. It's like the greatest thing that could ever happen. There's two words that Samuel Beckett, I love Samuel Beckett, and Samuel Beckett, two words, fail better. It's on my wall, fail better. You know, it's like, oh my God, that's the best thing you could ever say. Fail better. So I say these, and they always think I'm a little stupid and weird and whatnot, but they get it. No, they really get it. I mean, I've spoken to many, like, you know, if you hadn't said this, you know. I can't stress that enough, because it's about process. It's not about results. It's not about product. It's about your life in the moment. Can you be present? Can you learn? Can you listen? Can you make a mistake? And then you keep going. I learned from that. You know, it's not that I am teaching that. We share that. I mean, it's a very, what do you call that? It's a back and forth. It's not like I'm here and they're here. No way. That's why we're always in a circle. You know, we're always in a circle, and it's really intentional. And I'm a participant. I'm the facilitator for the group because I'm older, I'm experienced, I did all the crap. But when we're in those groups every Saturday, I'm learning as much as anybody else. I think it's real simple in this context because in essence, we basically, or I I hate to say I, we create an environment that basically gives people permission. We give people permission to be who they are. We give them permission, and it's not easy. It's really hard. People have struggled a lot in the program, not because of demands, but because people start to become aware of, oh, this is who I really am, you know? It was a beautiful thing. Massima was going through a transition with identity. I mean, it was amazing, you know? But I think that's true for just about everybody, you know, that there's a transition that I see people go through where I don't want to make it out to be like some magical, but I've seen so many of them because they're given the permission, because nobody's there to wag a finger or to create this horrible sort of education that's based on a punishment and reward. It's the opposite. No one gets punished and there are no rewards. You know, it's a collective experiment where we work together. We learn from each other. How? By learning how to listen, by building trust, and then challenging that trust. The trust always sometimes it gets broken. But the point being is that that is what allows people to see a different self, a different group, and a different world. And the challenge for us is, how do you sustain that? And that's really a problem, you know. But in terms of, not problem, it's really an issue to me. I'm really aware of that. But in terms of the program, I think the reason it's successful is because people really are given the license to make a mistake, not to feel they have to produce something, but to actually be present in the moment with a lot of people in the room is a real difficult thing to do. And if you can do that, you can do a lot. In terms of having a voice in the society, because we're working with what kinds of communities? We're working with people of color, with a trans, with gay, lesbian, with class. All these things come up every year. They all come up. And so it's a microcosm of society, but with 15, 20 people in the room concentrated, without that trust, we would get nowhere. All the issues that exist outside the studio come into the space, but that space is transformed for a little while so that we can make mistakes or we can grow together. But the fact is we stay together. And I think, to me, that's like really revelatory. Look, I'm I don't really say this very much, but I love what I do.
Yes.
I love what I do so much. I just feel so lucky. And at least being able to be a part of this and to be able to create that environment, there's a way where I could just say I could just die now, because I don't know if there's anything else I could achieve that's greater than that. Because to be in a place where I have seen so many people just do things that, who have the courage and just say, I'm going to just take a chance, right? And they do things. Oh, so I wish I could tell you, my God, it's just really amazing. I mean, our points of genius or points of where things have come together in such a way where there'll be a moment of awareness and consciousness. You see it in their eyes, right? You're like, boom, that's all you can ask for in life, right? I think a number of people have had that, you know? So there's been a lot of people this year. This year we had so many people that just really just blew me away, you know. And when that happens, if you ever get in a situation like that, what's beautiful about it is those moments continue to live in you. You know, it lives. It lives on. It doesn't just happen and it's gone. No, it lives. I know it lives in me. I know it lives in the person it happened to. And I know it lives in with participants, you know. So that's like, I know it's just an ephemeral kind of thing, but I think that means a lot, yeah.
So to close this, can you talk a little bit about the December project?
So the December project is, I'm doing a thing called Bang Bang Gun Amok. It's a 24-hour, I'm calling it a performance filibuster, but I think I'm changing that. I think it's going to be like a vigil testimony. And I'm dedicating 24 hours from Friday, December 8th to Saturday, December 9th on gun violence in the U.S. And originally it was going to be a literal filibuster where it was going to be me for 24 hours just going on and on and on, but just to hold the space. Now I'm inviting, that's not going to work. I'm going to be there for the 24 hours and I will be actively involved, but we're going to set up an environment where we have artists musicians, hopefully survivors of gun violence, mothers, activists, muralists. There's going to be hopefully a lot of things going on at once, you know, where we're going to talk about gun culture in the United States. And then also we're going to reach out to all the elected members of Congress, 538. So there's going to be real specific and legislature driven, but it's also going to be to talk about how the arts can open up a space for us to recognize and acknowledge we live in a violent society. And only when we take it to heart will it change, not simply around gun reform. I don't want it to be just about, are we going to get legislation? It's got to be how we live, how we think, how we coexist. So that's going to happen at Abrams. It's 5-year anniversary of Sandy Hook in December. Seems like a good time to remind people or bring it back. It's another way to talk about the administration we're under now, but not to talk about it directly, but to talk about it in terms of what's happening, even though the news is it's dominated by something that's really important in my eyes constitutionally, but too many things are going on under the radar that are really frightening. So the NRA, we had a president this year who went to the NRA to speak, and it's never happened. That to me says so much. And so, and I know about the support that the NRA gave. This is not an anti-NRA 24-hour thing, but they're going to be a part of it. Yeah. So that's what it is.
Thank you. I love it. Thank you for being Nostromo Native Daughter.